As we've been reporting for months, Venezuela is in a political and humanitarian crisis.
The economy is going into a spiral of dysfunctionality.
Been some beds left derelict. There's no money to repair them.
The highest inflation in the world.
4 million Venezuelan refugees. That's one of the largest groups of people displaced from any country anywhere in the world.
Venezuelans today cannot eat. You see people eating from the garbage.
There's no denying the crisis in Venezuela. The country teeters on the brink of total economic and social collapse. There's civil unrest, hospitals are empty, supermarkets are empty, and there's a very real possibility of an invasion by the United States of America. The Bolivarian Revolution, which is the political process initiated by the late President Hugo Chavez, has not borne its promised fruits. What happened in Venezuela? And what's in store for the country and its people? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute, TNI. I'm Sean Macheza. In today's edition, we hear from TNI fellows Professor Edgardo Lander and Dr. Daniel Chavez. And stay around till the end, where we'll hear some evocative poetry from Venezuelan poet Rachel Romay Diaz. In a presentation at a public event on the Venezuelan situation hosted by TNI in June, TNI fellow Daniel Chavez, being from Uruguay, gave an impression of what's happening through a Latin American lens.
We are following quite closely everything that is going on in Venezuela for several reasons. We have a very strong connection with that country because many people from my country came to Venezuela as exiles during the dictatorship, and now we have a quite large influx of Venezuelans who are coming as migrants, not as political migrants, but mainly as economic migrants to my country.
Daniel began by pointing out that focusing only on the current crisis hides some of the positive outcomes of the Bolivarian Revolution and would not be a fair appraisal of Venezuela's situation.
We shouldn't be talking only about the crisis, about what is going on. Because even though today we see this country as being really in crisis, we cannot forget that for people like me and many other people in the left, for many years the Bolivarian Revolution was really a beacon of hope. We really look at Venezuela as a totally different kind of process that could inspire similar changes in other countries and in other parts of the world. And there is a lot of data that show that Chavez policies greatly expanded access to health, education, food, rice, and land, especially for the poor. There were very ambitious social policies and other kind of governmental programs that really improved the quality of life of the majority of the Venezuelan population. And this also meant experimenting with new and innovative forms of participatory democracy. I guess you all heard about the community councils, the comunas, the mesas técnicas, the technical committees that were created for running public services such as water or electricity. From an academic theoretical point of view, we can have some criticism to how these processes were organized, how the money came in, how this meant some kind of extreme dependence on the state. But we cannot ignore that there was really some very interesting experimentation going on at the institutional level. And we cannot forget that Venezuelan government also promoted a people-centered model of regional integration that was totally different to the hegemonic model of neoliberal regional integration that is prevalent in the America. It is not by chance that in this picture we see Chavez with Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia, and Néstor Kirchner, the president of Argentina, former president. And unfortunately, 20 years later, the revolution is crumbling from within.
So while it started off positively, something went wrong with the dreams of the Bolivarian Revolution. It would be impossible to cover all the history in great detail, but I needed someone to give some brief insight into the events that have led to the current crisis. Edgardo Lande is a fellow of the Transnational Institute. He's a retired professor from the Central University in Caracas, a lifelong leftist activist, and a scholar who is part of a collective called the Citizens Platform in Defense of the Constitution, who are seeking a democratic, constitutional way out of the Venezuelan crisis. I asked him to help me understand what's going on.
I think now it's possible to argue that the Bolivarian process has failed. The situation in Venezuela is a lot worse than it was 20 years ago, and there's many causes for that. Bolivarian process can be sort of broken up in different stages to understand how we got to where we are. The first stage was from the election of Chavez to around 2006, 2007, around there. This was a process in which the notion of a Bolivarian revolution was very wide open. I mean, they didn't have a blueprint. I mean, you couldn't define policies for oil or for things like that from Bolivar's letters and so on. And so it was very open discussion, processes of popular organization, and great creativity and diversity in the whole process that really sort of changed political culture. It was really amazing. And Chavez played an enormous role in terms of his charisma, his pedagogic capacity, talking to people, etc., etc.
Due to high oil prices, Venezuela could afford to fund massive social programs, such as housing, education, health, and other social services. The country's economic clout also led to a great role in the economic fortunes of the entire region, including loans to neighboring countries. However, as Edgardo explains, there were some storm clouds on the horizon.
Transition started when Chavez, in 2005, in Porto Alegre, in the context of the social forum, declared that the Bolivarian Revolution was a socialist revolution. And that had enormous implications, because it sort of put a blueprint on the table.
The socialist blueprint came with attempts to formalize the people's power, to build a single party for the revolution, which led to a conflation of the party and the state, and also to the creation of a massive but corrupt bureaucracy to operationalize that control. By calling the revolution a socialist revolution, Chavez also set the stage for another classical confrontation.
As confrontation with the right became more sort of intense, people sort of back to known territories, and the known territory was sort of socialism against capitalism.
The choice to declare a socialist revolution set Venezuela on an accelerated direct collision course with the United States. Chavez was not going to be around to see that battle to the end. Before his death, he managed to win one last election for his party in 2012. And the next year, Maduro, his chosen successor, took over as president.
And Maduro lacked the leadership capacity of Chavez. So he lacked the legitimacy in the Venezuelan population that Chavez once had. And there was no way that anybody could possibly replace Chavez in terms of his leadership and his charisma, his ability to put together all the forces that were...
He was the cog in a massive wheel, basically.
Yeah. Chavismo has always been quite diverse, and he was sort of the unifying figure, and he always made the final decision.
Yeah.
But once you take that away, then everything...
There's no coherence.
Maduro consolidated his power through political repression, censorship, and electoral manipulation. In 2017, the government issued an indefinite ban on all protests, imprisoned political adversaries, and dissolved the National Assembly. In May 2018, Maduro secured re-election in a race that the United States and other powers condemned as unfair and undemocratic.
From then on, we haven't had a really free election. There were always sort of semi-elections because there were so many disturbances in the way.
Yeah.
And the government became also more repressive. in terms of the opposition, in terms of labor organizations, in terms of people's mobilizations, and it became more and more.
So you've been internally with the people who are initially supporting them.
And of course, support for the government sort of continued to go down as a consequence of these policies.
The death of Hugo Chavez and the ascendancy of the less charismatic Nicolas Maduro had massive political implications in the story of the country. But Venezuela's economic problems were even more pressing. In a classic example of what has been called the Dutch disease, up to 96% of Venezuela's foreign currency came from oil exports. When Maduro took over, the oil-reliant economy was already in trouble. But when global oil prices dropped in 2014, businesses were no longer able to import goods at the same rate as before, which led to high prices and inflation. But the worst blow to the country's economy was the imposition of sanctions by the United States. Compounded by the endemic corruption, the sanctions brought the country to its knees.
The Venezuelan economy is sort of strangling and is coming to a standstill. The Venezuelan Central Bank finally published some economic statistics that it hadn't published for 4 years. And one of the most amazing things is that they recognize that industrial production is today 75% less than it was 4 years ago. Even in a war situation, the sort of thing that happened. And it's like the total destruction of the country. So you have a situation where we have a government that really can govern. It's a government only by name. It can guarantee water. It can guarantee electricity. It can guarantee public transportation. It can guarantee access to gasoline for people to move around. It's a bureaucracy that's just sitting there. I mean, they really can't do anything. Yeah. And if you see Maduro announce himself on television, it's like complete irreality. I mean, he keeps us announcing this great project, and now I'm announcing the great transportation revolution in the country, and then all the trains, and so many buses, and the metro's going to... And people look at that and say, what country is he living in?
This combination of factors opened up a political opportunity for a relatively unknown opposition politician, Juan Guaido. The intricacies of the political process that led to Guaido's rise in prominence are difficult to disentangle in the space of a few minutes. But the impact he has had on the political landscape is undeniable.
Soon after he was elected president of the assembly, he self-proclaimed himself as the legitimate president of Venezuela, because he didn't recognize the results of the last year's presidential elections, which were not very legitimate. And he wasn't the major political figure in the country. And from one day to another, he sort of became the national figure in opposition to Maduro, with great backing and great capacity of mobilization of the, I mean, the majority of the people that oppose Maduro nowadays. Yeah. And he managed to unify all this right-wing opposition, not necessarily in backing for him, or, but just the fact that finally they found someone. And there were so many confrontations between the different leaderships that this guy was seen as not much of a threat, because he was a younger guy, he wasn't involved in previous conflicts, and so, I mean, he really got some immense backing. But he generated, as a consequence, great expectations.
Since Guaido's declaration, Venezuela has been in a political stalemate, with the pendulum of power swinging to either side, but never far enough to tip the balance. There's been much back and forth, and local, regional, and international lobbying from both sides. There have been two specific incidents where Guaido has tried to push Maduro's hand. The first, in February 2019, was an attempt to bring in a consignment of American aid via the land border with Colombia. This led to intense tensions with Venezuela's government.
There was a highly, highly coordinated effort with the United States government to use this as a way to really get rid of Maduro. The assumption was that just massive amounts of Venezuelans would come to the frontier, receive this U.S. aid. The armed forces would be asked to repress, they wouldn't, they would withdraw their support from the Maduro government, and that was it.
The second came in April, when Guaido, with soldiers standing behind him and supposedly speaking from La Calota Air Base in Caracas, claimed that the military was ready to support him and called for Venezuelans to take to the streets.
The armed forces didn't move. There weren't that many people on the frontier. Really nothing important happened, except the fact that it was shown on television worldwide.
Yeah.
And it showed that his notion that Maduro was very weak and he could just be blown away really wasn't the case.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a bet of the U.S. government as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this
they were hoping to just light a match
and that was it. Yeah.
So I had to ask Edgardo, going forward, what can we expect to happen in Venezuela?
I think right now, in spite of all this drama,
I'm
somewhat optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
I see a sparkle of light at the end of the tunnel. Because you have a situation where both sides have to recognize, whether they want it or not,
mm-hmm.
that they can't exterminate the other one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this notion of politics as a confrontation with the enemy, in which you just simply do away with the enemy, it's not likely to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Maduro can possibly exterminate the will of the majority of the population.
Mm-hmm.
He can't ignore U.S. sanctions or the threat of military intervention. But at the same time, Guaido's people can't get rid of Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can't sort of just get rid of the army.
Yeah.
And the fact that's usually not recognized by the Venezuelan right and many observers from outside Venezuela is the fact that Maduro still has some popular backing. I can show you some of the statistics from some of the more recent and serious opinion polls.
Mm-hmm.
Maduro has backing of 18-20%, whatever.
That's still significant.
And if you have 20 million voters and you have, that's 4 million people. If there was a coup or there was a sort of change of government by force, etc., these people will react.
Mm-hmm. And we do have precedents of people reacting and stopping something
like this. Yeah. Well, when it happened to 2002, the great majority of the population supported Chavez.
Yeah.
This isn't the case now.
It's a different case.
But it's still, a very significant proportion of the population. And the armed forces are part of the government. It's not something you can get rid of from one day to another. And they had to recognize that there are two parts of Venezuelan society, that no matter what the transition or the solution to this, both sides will continue to form part of Venezuelan society,
mm-hmm.
and they have to learn to recognize each other and sort of live together in this society.
Yeah.
And that can only happen through negotiations.
Edgardo is working with a small but broad coalition that is seeking a democratic, sovereign, and life-affirming solution to the crisis.
We decided to call ourselves the Citizens Platform in Defense of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
arguing that first, the basic problems in Venezuelan society are not in the Constitution, but in the systematic violation of the Constitution by the government
mm-hmm.
and by the opposition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're calling for something that's contemplated in the Constitution
mm-hmm.
in situations of severe crisis, is to consult the population in a consultative referendum.
Uh-huh.
This has started to gain some track.
Yeah.
Now we have an alliance called the Alliance for the Consultative Referendum
mm-hmm.
with a few tiny but existing left groupings and parties
mm-hmm.
and some intellectuals, etc.
Yeah.
And so we're putting this forward, a constitutional solution, because it's very important. It's not only a question of getting rid of Maduro.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you get rid of Maduro.
Right.
And if you break the Constitution and sort of go outside the Constitution, anything could happen.
Yeah.
Anything could happen. The same thing as with the U.S. intervention. The experience of U.S. interventions in the world, we know what it is. Latin America, we've had it again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And we have very recent history in the case of Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. We know what happens.
And what about those of us watching from the outside? What are we to take from this?
We need solidarity with the Venezuelan people, not with the Venezuelan government. The fact that there's military threats against the Venezuelan government should not lead to back the Maduro government. Because this is not a leftist government. This is a repressive, neoliberal government in terms of its policies. And it's destroyed the economy. And it's doing great harm to the Venezuelan population. Second, we need as much solidarity as possible to make it clear that the peoples of the world reject a U.S. intervention. And we need backing for that. We need solidarity for that. I mean, that has to become an issue that's known across the world because it's a real threat. I mean, if you see the people, I mean, from Trump, you never know what to expect. But when you have people like Bolton or Pence or Elliot Abrams, these are war criminals. I mean, Bolton was directly responsible for all the fake building up of the intervention in Iraq. Elliot Abrams was responsible for massive killings in Central America. He was responsible for the Reagan policies in relation to Nicaragua and the Contras, etc. I mean, these are war criminals. Trump so far has been sort of the...
If Trump is the one holding back...
Yeah, he's the voice of reason, so you can imagine.
Yeah.
So that's another thing.
No intervention.
No intervention. A third thing is that, and this is for the left, it's the fact that it's extremely important to have a nuanced reading, an informed nuanced reading of Venezuelan reality. If there's two sides in confrontation, you don't necessarily have to be on one side or the other. From U.S. sanctions, you can't conclude that it's not the government's fault. From the threat of U.S. intervention, military intervention, you can't conclude that we need solidarity, anti-imperialist solidarity with the Maduro government. We need solidarity with the Venezuelan people. And that's related with the experience of the left in relation to so-called progressive and leftist governments. It seems that the left is incapable of learning from experience. We have to remember what happened with Stalinism. I mean, a good part of the international left, especially the left in Europe, decided that they couldn't criticize or denounce Stalin's crimes because this was the only real anti-imperialist force in the world, so you couldn't criticize the Soviet Union, etc. But, I mean, as a consequence, see what's happening in Eastern Europe. The most right-wing governments in the world practically are now in Eastern Europe as a result of that.
Policy, yeah.
I mean, if that's socialism, I don't want anything to do with socialism.
So
we need to rethink our experience. We need to rethink socialism. We have to rethink the left. Because otherwise we're destroying the possibilities of anti-capitalist struggles. Because this is what it's been identified with.
Yeah.
Socialism has become a bad word in Venezuela. And it's not highly credible in the whole Latin America today, as a consequence of the failure of this progressive government that offered deep transformation and ended up with extractive policies that sort of integrated this economies more and more into the international division of labor and nature. So, I mean, we need more self-criticism, we need more awareness, we need to discuss the complexities of the processes, and we have to learn from experience. Otherwise, we just keep on repeating the same thing over and over and over.
That was Edgardo Lander, a TNI fellow, sharing his thoughts about his homeland, Venezuela. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. TNI is an international research and advocacy institute committed to building a just, democratic, and sustainable planet. For more than four decades, we've supported the major social movements of the day, providing them with research, ideas, as well as logistical support. We're based in Amsterdam, and we believe there are alternatives to the world as it currently exists. We hope you believe this too. Thank you so much for listening this far. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you would like to find out more about TNI's work, please look us up at www.tni.org and find us on social media
at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook. As I promised earlier, and to round up today's podcast, here's a recording of Venezuelan poet Rachel Rumay Diaz sharing a poem about her homeland at TNI's event held on the 6th of June, 2019.
There is no chart, data, article, or analysis you can read or watch on YouTube that can tell you the truth about what it's like to live in Venezuela. But if you listen, I can try to explain. I come from conquered soil and invaded wombs, stolen tongues and sacred ruins. I come from bloodshed, spilled onto land, spilled into me, daughter of women of the land and men who have disappeared. I come from donde está la patria. Without freedom, this means nothing to me. There is no left or right when it comes to saving a life. There is only moving forward in democracy. I come from stories forbidden to be told, so they are locked up in the night. I come from la lucha. This means I am ready to fight. I come from hold my hand. Stay with me. Hands off means blood on your hands. Don't let go of me. Instead, put your heart on me. Believe me when I speak. Don't silence me. Ask me about my country. Don't speak for me. Ask me and I will tell you I come from fearless women, bearers of stolen children in the night, carriers of unborn legacies, protectors of those who have given up the fight. Ask me about the warriors too young to have died. Justice in my country still has the highest price. Ask me about the students who paid with their lives. Ask me who hold the weapons. Ask me who turned off the lights. Ask me who burnt the food, the medicine. Ask me who are the ones that can survive. And I will tell you, the body can survive 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. The body can wrap its limbs around itself and trick the mind into feeling loved. Hold its breath for decades and wait for something that will never happen. The body can teach itself to survive and watch its muscles forget all its memories. No hay mal que dure 100 años, ni cuerpo que lo resista. There is no evil that can last for 100 years or a body that can resist it. How is my country not the map of my body? My ribcage home to the largest city, a capital that pumps blood through all that is of me, Caracas. La ciudad herida, the wounded city. I bleed yellow, blue, and red if you cut me. My lungs vast and wide like el campo, the countryside. My tears sweet like the Orinoco River when they run down my cheeks. I cry the sounds of the arp, the galloping horses, the snares of a guitar. My eyes sing the anthem of the land, Alma Llanera. Soul of the plains. How is my body not the map of my country? My thighs, the golden sands of costas caribeñas, the Caribbean coasts. How do the freckles on my body not form islands? Admired by men who drew blood that gave the soil its color. Isla Margarita, pearl of the Caribbean, battleground of someone else's war. How do the R's that roll on my tongue not cascade out of me like El Salto Ángel, tallest waterfall in the world, baptized by my forefathers in a language that was erased? How am I not La Gran Sabana, El Coro, Morrocoy? All of these landmarks of my country, all of these part of me. How does a body live if its country is dying? Left an empty shell unable to lick its wounds, a prisoner of powerlessness. Where do you rest your head when home is a place where no house can be built? my mouth echoes the remnants of what is left of si se puede. Yes, we can. But all you can is to wish for hope to come back. My heart beats to a rhythm that hasn't been made into a song for decades. I can't remember the words, but I know it's Alma Llanera, because my soul is still lingering in the plains. How does a body mourn the death of a country without mourning its own life? Years without air, weeks without water, every day without food. My body can no longer be home to your political playground. But you can only know if you ask me. So ask me. Ask a Venezuelan.